cardiac arrest. In certain areas of conspiracist right-leaning social media, there is this attribution that it's because of a COVID vaccine rather than the fact that a 6'4", 220-pound opponent struck him in the chest running full force.
Right.
I am a medical doctor. I can tell you that one of those causes is far more likely, and I think it has more to do with the one that's going to knock you on your back rather than needing a band-aid on your deltoid. However, I don't think you need 10 years of postgraduate training to know that.
I don't think so. Yeah. And again, we do not even know the vaccination status of Damar Hamlin, or at least we didn't as of yesterday when I last read about this. And there are so many leaps in logic that are being made here that it is really, it's truly a scary thing that these folks for whom, again, they've got a hammer, which is vaccines are bad. That's their hammer. So everything is a nail. Someone gets COVID. Oh, it's because of the vaccine. Someone has a heart attack. It's because of the vaccine. Someone dies, it's because of the vaccine. Everything is the vaccine because all they've got is a hammer, and it's a really sad situation. We've got, and a destructive one, I should add. Great bonus show for you today. We'll talk about something interesting going on with millennials in politics, Southwest Airlines involved in a controversy, a MAGA hat wearing teacher has been, in a sense, vindicated legally. All of it is on the bonus show today.
Oh, the bonus show where you want to make money.
Yeah.
Everybody else that makes money to fund themselves is bad.
Sign up at joinpacman.com and we will see you then. Republicans have yet again failed to elect a Speaker of the House, despite being poised to take control and swear in their new elected members like George Santos, who has not actually been sworn in yet, even though he said he was. We'll get to that later. Despite the endorsement of the failed former President Donald Trump, Kevin McCarthy has lost again and again and yes, again. That makes it six total times. And this exposes, number one, the complete inability to actually lead and get things done productively, even in the easiest of circumstances, like we have control, let's pick a speaker. It exposes increasingly the potentially dwindling power and prestige, to the extent that there was ever prestige, of the MAGA portion of the Republican Party. And it also raises real national security questions. When you don't have a speaker, there are national security risks. We will talk about that later as well. Rolling Stone reporting McCarthy loses again despite nod from Trump. The House of Representatives has rejected the California representative for a fourth and probably not final time on Wednesday, subsequently rejecting him a fifth time and then a sixth time. And then the voting set to pick back up again today. I'm sure by the time you listen to today's program, we may know more. There may have been more votes. Now, the despite the nod from Trump is very interesting. Today's Thursday. Yesterday was Wednesday. On Tuesday, when the first votes for McCarthy failed, people, NBC News went to Trump and said, "Do you still support McCarthy?" And he didn't respond. Much later on in the day, Trump spoke to people, presumably checked out what Tucker Carlson was saying, Sean Hannity and others. And then he issued on Wednesday morning the following, not reluctant, but not exactly the most ringing endorsement of Kevin McCarthy, saying on Truth Social,
Truth Central,
quote, "Some really good conversations took place last night. And it's now time for all of our great Republican House members to vote for Kevin, close the deal, take the victory, and watch crazy Nancy Pelosi fly back home to a very broken California. The only speaker in U.S. history to have lost the House twice. Republicans do not turn a great triumph into a giant, embarrassing defeat. It's time to celebrate. You deserve it. Kevin McCarthy will do a good job, maybe even a great job. Just watch. Not exactly a full-throated endorsement, and it appears not to have quite been enough, not to be quite enough to get Kevin McCarthy over the finish line. Now, I wrongly assumed yesterday.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCD Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I'm going to return to Brasilia now. I'm going to visit the three sites that were damaged. Be assured that this will not be repeated. To discover who financed this, who paid for their stay, and they will have to pay the price under the law.
More than 400 people have been arrested in Brazil after supporters of former President Jair Bolsonaro stormed the Brazilian Congress, Supreme Court, and Presidential Palace in a scene reminiscent of the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. Brazil's new president, Lula, has vowed to investigate and prosecute those who took part in what's being called an attempted coup. We'll go to Brazil for the latest. Then we look at Joe Biden's first trip to the U.S.-Mexico border as president.
We are really hoping that this will be a turn of event, that the Biden administration will stand on the right side of history to welcome people with dignity instead of using policies to deter them.
And Harvard University is facing condemnation after rescinding a fellowship to Kenneth Roth, the former head of Human Rights Watch, over the group's criticism of Israel's human rights record. We'll get the latest. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Brazil, supporters of far-right former President Jair Bolsonaro stormed the Congress, Supreme Court, and Presidential Palace in the capital, Brasilia, Sunday. Police arrested over 400 rioters as they cleared them from the government buildings after the mob trashed offices, broke windows, destroyed computer equipment and artwork that was on display. The attack came 1 week after the inauguration of returning President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who spoke following the attack.
All those people who did this will be found and punished. They will realize that democracy guarantees the right to freedom and free speech, but it also demands that people respect the institutions created to strengthen democracy. And these people, these vandals, what could we say? They're fanatical Nazis, fanatical fascists. They did what has never been done in this country.
Bolsonaro supporters have refused to accept his election loss, and Bolsonaro never formally conceded, instead leaving Brazil for Florida, as some U.S. lawmakers are now calling for him to be extradited. Brazil's Supreme Court ordered all pro-Bolsonaro protest camps around the country to be dismantled within 24 hours, for roadblocks to be lifted, and for police to arrest any protesters defying the orders. The court also suspended the governor of Brasilia as security flaws around the government buildings are investigated. As nations around the world condemned the attack, the day's events drew immediate comparisons to the January 6th Capitol insurrection in Washington, D.C. We'll go to Brazil for the latest after headlines. In El Paso, Texas, President Biden visited the U.S.-Mexico border Sunday for the first time since taking office 2 years ago. Biden briefly toured a migrant shelter where he did not meet with any migrants because apparently none were there at the time. The president instead met with Border Patrol agents, Congress members and local officials, including Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott, who continues to intensify his anti-immigrant hate speech. Abbott handed Biden a letter with a list of demands on border enforcement. Biden's trip to El Paso came just days after announcing another extension of the Trump-era Title 42 pandemic policy to block Haitian, Cuban, and Nicaraguan migrants apprehended in the southern border from seeking asylum. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. California Republican Kevin McCarthy was elected House Speaker in the early hours of Saturday morning after a historic 15 rounds of voting. McCarthy was forced to make a flurry of concessions to the hard right faction of the Republican Party, which will hold significant power in the new Congress. One of the most dramatic moments in the drawn out process came during the 14th round of voting Friday, when Congressmember Matt Gaetz refused to vote for McCarthy, instead voting present, leaving the embattled Republican leader one vote short of a victory and prompting an angry Congressmember, Mike Rogers of Alabama, to yell and lunge at Gaetz before the Republican was restrained by North Carolina Congressmember Richard Hudson, who put his hand over Rogers' mouth. McCarthy was eventually elected on the 15th ballot with 216 votes to 212 for Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries. Six Republicans did not vote for McCarthy, instead casting present votes, which was enough to secure McCarthy's victory. After the four-day saga wrapped up, McCarthy credited former President Trump with helping him clinch the speakership.
But I do want to especially thank President Trump. I don't think anybody should doubt his influence. He was with me from the beginning. Somebody wrote the doubt of whether he was there, and he was all in.
McCarthy's election meant the House was finally able to swear in lawmakers Saturday. They included New York Republican George Santos, who's being investigated over his finances and for completely fabricating large portions of his resume and life history. Before taking his oath of office, Santos was seen making a hand gesture that many have called out as a white supremacist symbol during the 10th round of voting for House Speaker. New York Democrat Jamal Bowman tweeted, quote, "We've all been laughing at Santos for lying his way to Congress. This time it ain't funny. He and every other white supremacist in Congress need to be expelled immediately," Bowman tweeted. As House members prepare to vote on a new rules package today, some Republicans say they will withhold their vote unless full details are shared of the concessions made by McCarthy to the far-right lawmakers. Some of the known deals include allowing a single Republican lawmaker to force a motion to vacate McCarthy's position as Speaker, and a provision allowing lawmakers to propose amendments to appropriation bills that could defund programs Republicans oppose. The rules package would also gut the Office of Congressional Ethics, barring it from hiring new staffers while retroactively imposing term limits on members of its board, which would remove three of four Democrats. Republicans also plan to eliminate labor unions of congressional staffers after the Congressional Workers Union negotiated its first ever contract just last month. China lifted nearly all its travel restrictions Sunday after 3 years of relative isolation since the start of the COVID pandemic. Incoming travelers no longer need to quarantine upon arrival. China also opened its land and sea borders with Hong Kong as tens of thousands of people streamed to and from the mainland.
I'm so happy, so happy, so excited. I haven't seen my parents for many years. My parents are not in good health, and I couldn't go back to see them even when they had colon cancer. So I'm really happy to go back and see them now.
This comes amidst a massive coronavirus surge in China since the rollback of its zero COVID policy. The recent spike in deaths of celebrities and public figures has sowed further doubt about the reliability of official COVID reports, even as their causes of death have not been confirmed. 40-year-old opera singer Chu Lan Lan and screenwriter Ni Zhen, who wrote the acclaimed film Raise the Red Lantern, are among the recently deceased. The UN and others have called out Beijing for underrepresenting the country's true COVID death toll after it stopped publishing daily data. Iran has executed two more men in connection with the ongoing nationwide uprising sparked by the September death of Mahsa Amini while in custody of Iran's so-called morality police. One of the men was 22-year-old Mohammad Mehdi Karami, an Iranian Kurdish karate champion. The other, 39-year-old factory worker Syed Mohammad Husseini. There have been four known executions linked to the protest movement, with at least nine other prisoners sentenced to death. On Thursday, authorities arrested reporter Mehdi Baik, who has interviewed the families of death row prisoners. Meanwhile, Iran released prominent actress Tarana Aladousti last week, star of the Oscar-winning film The Salesman. She was detained after voicing support for the protests. In Kenya, a prominent LGBTQ plus activist, Edwin Chiloba, was found murdered and left in a metal box by a roadside near the town of Eldoret. Four suspects have been arrested. Same-sex intercourse is punishable in Kenya by up to 14 years in prison, and discrimination against the LGBTQ community is widespread. Edwin Chiloba's sister spoke out after her brother's body was found.
He told me this would be the greatest year for him. I did not know that he was going to get killed. I am really shocked. For those people who did it, I pray for justice. I am appealing to the government to investigate this. He was a boy with dreams.
In climate news, a new report finds human activity is causing Utah's Great Salt Lake to shrink far faster than previously believed, and that without dramatic cuts to water consumption in the American West, the lake could disappear entirely in the next 5 years. Since 2020, the lake has lost 40 billion gallons of water each year and now holds just 37% of its normal volume. It's currently about 4 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than it was in the early 1900s. Researchers warn the dry lake bed threatens to expose millions of people to toxic dust that could increase rates of asthma, heart disease, and other ailments. Here in New York, over 7,000 nurses went on strike early today after failing to reach a new contract agreement with Mount Sinai Hospital and Montefiore Medical Center. Nurses are demanding higher wages, a stop to benefit cuts, and for more staff to be hired to treat a growing number of patients. The nurses are also denouncing the inhumane treatment of patients, as some have been forced to receive medical care in hospital hallways due to overcrowding. In a statement, the New York State Nurses Association urged people to continue seeking the care they need, writing, quote, "We appreciate solidarity from our patients, but going into the hospital to get the care you need is not crossing our strike line. We are out here so we can provide better patient care to you," they said. And in Florida, the descendants of black people who survived racial violence in the town of Rosewood gathered over the weekend to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the massacre. Over the course of several days in January 1923, a white mob razed the homes of black families, murdering at least 6 people, forcing others to flee. Many eyewitnesses said the true death toll was far higher. The violence began after a white woman accused a black man of assault. In 1994, Florida lawmakers approved $2 million in compensation for 9 survivors and dozens of descendants of the attack. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, they were the only government reparations ever paid to victims of anti-black racial violence in the United States. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Brazil, where thousands of supporters of the former far-right president Jair Bolsonaro stormed the Brazilian Congress, Supreme Court, and presidential palace Sunday in a scene reminiscent of the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. The rioters, many dressed in green and yellow, the colors of the Brazilian flag, smashed windows, ransacked offices, even set fire to a carpet inside the Congress building. Authorities eventually regained control of the buildings, made over 400 arrests. This all came 1 week after the inauguration of President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva of the Workers' Party, who defeated Bolsonaro in October. Bolsonaro has never formally conceded the race. Just last week, a few days before Lula's inauguration, he fled to Florida, where he was reportedly met with Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago. Over the past 2 months, Bolsonaro supporters have blockaded highways and set up protest encampments outside military bases and in the capital to protest what they falsely claim was a rigged election. Lula, who was not in the capital at the time, condemned Sunday's attempt to overthrow his government by what he called fanatical fascists.
I'm going to return to Brasilia now. I'm going to visit the 3 sites that were damaged. Be assured that this will not be repeated, to discover who financed this, who paid for their stay, and they will have to pay the price under the law. Like true vandals destroying what they found in front of them, we think that there was a lack of security, and I want to tell you that. All those people who did this will be found and punished. They will realize that democracy guarantees the right to freedom and free speech, but it also demands that people respect the institutions created to strengthen democracy. And these people, these vandals, what could we say? They're fanatical Nazis, fanatical fascists. They did what has never been done in this country.
Zul's former president, Jair Bolsonaro, responded to Sunday's attempted coup by writing on Twitter, quote, "Peaceful demonstrations within the law are part of democracy, but depredations and invasions of public buildings like we saw today, like the acts done by the left in 2013 and 2017, are not within the rules," he said. We're joined now by two guests. Michael Fox is a freelance journalist, former editor of NACLA, and host of the podcast Brazil on Fire, the podcast a joint project of NACLA and the Real News Network. Thiago Amparo is a professor of international law and human rights. He is also a columnist for the well, you can pronounce it for me so I don't pronounce it wrong, Professor Amparo.
It's a Folha de São Paulo. It's the main newspaper in Brazil.
Well, thank you so much for being with us, to both of you. Professor Amparo, let's begin with you. What happened in Brasilia, the capital of Brazil, yesterday?
So, first, thank you very much for having me. What happened yesterday was something that unprecedented in our history. What happened was the invasion of the executive, the presidential palace, the House of the Congress, and also the Supreme Court floor. So that's, and what happened was a massive invasion of those buildings, physical destruction of historical documents, physical destruction of the buildings. The whole floor of the Supreme Court was destroyed. What began days before that, over the weekend, several buses arrived to Brasilia to join the protesters that were camping outside of the headquarters of the army in Brasilia. They were there for many months, but since Saturday and Friday, several people had joined the protests and joined the invaders, and then it became very abruptly from protests to this massive invasion that was unprecedented in our history. So that's what happened in Brazil yesterday.
You have said this is far bigger than the U.S. January 6th insurrection. Mm-hmm. Explain.
So I would say that there are several parallels, of course, because of the date and also the rhetoric, and also one fact-checking agency yesterday, Agência Pública in Brazil, said that even the hashtag that people were using was inspired by the January 6th in the United States. So there are obvious parallels. But on the other hand, the scale is much bigger because if it was in the United States, it would be like if people were invading not only the Capitol, the Congress, but also the White House and also the Supreme Court floor and leaving it all destroyed. So this is what happened in terms of the scale. Secondly, in the United States, they were trying to, at least rhetorically, they were trying to prevent the certification of the U.S. Election of Joe Biden. In Brazil, what happened, basically, Lula was already certified and is already the president of Brazil. So what's the goal of the invaders? It's still under debate, but probably what they are trying to do first is to show their strength, but secondly, even to overthrow momentarily overthrow the power of the president, Lula. So this is in terms of the effect and the goal that they have, and also the scale of the what happened yesterday, I would say that is even bigger than what happened in January 6th in the United States.
And the significance of Bolsonaro not being there, though they're being called, of course, Bolsonaristas, but having fled, or you could say flown out of the country a few days before Lula's inauguration, instead of being there to show the peaceful transference of power, he flew to Orlando and apparently has since reportedly met with Trump. He is known as the Trump of the tropics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it was also part of the strategy because during the whole presidency, not only during the electoral cycle, Bolsonaro was spreading fake news about the electoral system and say that it was fraudulent. So it was very clear that the President Trump, President Bolsonaro, was even attacking since the day one the electoral system. And it was very clear by the last day, during the last days of his presidency, that he was not clearly saying that Lula won the election. He after the election results, he went silent. And a few days before the inauguration and the traditional passage of the mandate in a symbolic act that we usually we have in on the January 1st of the new president in office, he did not go. He did not attend this event. He went before a few days before to the United States and stayed there. And one interesting thing that happened also yesterday is that the person responsible for the security of the federal district where Brasilia is situated, is Anderson Torres. He's a former Minister of Justice of Bolsonaro. And during the protest yesterday, the invasion yesterday, he actually was in the United States as well on vacation. So you see that it's very clear that first Bolsonaro was trying to not, was very clearly not saying that he lost the election. He, for many years, he was saying that it was a fraudulent election, which was not, spreading fake news. And also the people were very clearly motivated by his rhetoric of challenging the institutions and attacking especially the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court justice that tried to fight against fake news during the electoral cycle.
I'm looking at a piece in the Daily Beast, Michael Fox, that quotes Steve Bannon, the President Trump advisor, who wrote Sunday, "Brazilian freedom fighters" is what he called those that are supporting Bolsonaro and have laid siege to the Congress, to the Supreme Court, to the presidential palace in Brasilia. Can you talk about who's supporting these rioters in the United States?
Well, the connection between Bolsonaro, Trump, far right Trump supporters, and of course, Steve Bannon. I mean, the connection between Steve Bannon and the Bolsonaro family runs deep, going back to even before Bolsonaro had won, back in 2018. It was his son, Eduardo Bolsonaro, who first got in contact with Steve Bannon. There was supposedly he was then helping Bolsonaro on the campaign trail in 2018. Eduardo Bolsonaro is the head of Steve Bannon's The Movement, his international far-right group, to try and foment exactly what's happening in Brazil right now across Latin America. And in fact, we saw this after the first round and the second round of the elections. Steve Bannon came out just the day afterwards talking about fraud, talking about the electoral machines. He was spewing this same information in a big conference in the U.S., talking about how Bolsonaro was going to win if it weren't for the fraud. So absolutely, Steve Bannon and his network has been absolutely backing Bolsonaro and trying to foment exactly what we saw today. And the connections between January 6th, January 8th, it's just so symbolic.
You also have one of the January 6th riot organizers, Ali Alexander, lauding the insurrectionists in Brazil, writing on Donald Trump's Truth Social platform, "I do not denounce unannounced impromptu Capitol tours by the people." So what if people like Steve Bannon and Alexander support Bolsonaro and the activists who are outside and destroying parts of the presidential palace, the Capitol, and the Supreme Court? Why does that matter? How much power do they have?
It matters, Amy, because it's not just Steve Bannon. He's part of this much larger far-right network, and these people are sharing experiences, and they're sharing. Listen, this is what you need to do. This is how we're going to make this happen. And this is exactly what we saw. This is a copycat situation. You had January 6th, you have January 8th, and they're trying to export this type of thing around the world. I mean, this is what Bolsonaro is. He's the Trump of the tropics because he embraced everything that Trump is and was, right? He pushed fascist ideology, pushed, lies, far-right lies, and basically everything that Trump pushed, trying to stir his people up in the streets, trying to push conspiracy theories. Bolsonaro was doing the same thing in the United States. We're talking about the parallels between the U.S. and Brazil run so, so deep. The same idea of exporting this kind of culture war into Brazil, which, of course, it happened automatically within Brazil, but also the evangelical movement, the connections. And I talk a lot about this, you know, in my podcast, Brazil on Fire, and these really, really deep connections and how these are being exported abroad on purpose and embraced by Bolsonaro and a far-right imagery. Now, what's concerning here, Amy, and the great difference between January 6th and, of course, this situation, January 8th, is the role of the military and the power of the military historically in Brazil. Of course, the imagery of the dictatorship was not long ago that Brazil had a 21-year dictatorship. It only ended in 1985. Many of the people who were in the streets just yesterday, they look back to that as a time of great wealth. They enjoy the dictatorship. They're authoritarian. They want dictatorship, which is something that Bolsonaro has been pushing since he came into office. So it's really important to understand the role that these players are playing, that Trump and Steve Bannon and his allies are playing in the United States, and the great impact that this can have abroad.
Professor Amparo, if you can talk about what you see is now going to happen. You had the Supreme Court saying that all the Bolsonaro encampments have to be taken down within 24 hours, which at the time of this broadcast is just a few hours from now. What about the role of the military and Lula calling out the military to deal with these protesters?
So I think, Amy, the main challenge here is there are institutional challenges here because the army officials, and just for the viewers and to understand, is that for the past months, there are a lot of people camping outside of the headquarters of the army in several capitals in Brazil, asking for a military intervention and military dictatorship and things like this. And so these people were outside there at the headquarters of the army. And the army was resisting any kind of forceful way of removing people from those camps. The camps are military areas that should not have gatherings of civilians outside of those areas. So there is a first institutional challenge because the armed officials are resisting any kind of intervention by the police and by the authorities in those areas. So just yesterday, after the decision of the Supreme Court, right in the middle of the chaos, they decided that the camps should be taken down, as you mentioned. The first reaction of the army in Brasilia was to not allow the police to enter that area. So there was a negotiation to allow them to enter that area and do their job, which was remove the people from outside of those camps. A lot of invaders that were in the capital, that were attacking the buildings, they went back to the camps and they were allowed to stay in the camps. So there was institutional tension between the police, the security forces, and the armed officials. Some of them are actually supporters of former President Bolsonaro. So there is a challenge on the ground there. But also in the legal accountability, one thing that the Supreme Court is trying to do now is trying to see who paid for it. So basically follow the money in terms of there are a lot of buses, more than 100 buses that arrived to the federal district in the capital of Brazil over the weekend. So who paid for the buses? Even the Supreme Court decision, there is the list of the numbers of those buses to try to define who financed this. So there is a question also not only of removing people from those military areas should not allow for this kind of invasion to happen again for security reasons, but also to there will be a lot of discussions about what kind of legal accountability of people on the ground. More than 100 people were arrested yesterday, but also people who financed and people who coordinated this kind of event. We saw yesterday some U.S. Lawmakers calling for former President Bolsonaro to be expelled from the United States and to face justice in Brazil. So there was a lot of discussion on the ground, what's going to happen with those camps, but also the legal accountability of who financed it and who coordinated this kind of event.
We just have 30 seconds. Michael Fox, do you think the military could side against Lula?
I don't think the military is going to side against Lula. There are definitely sectors of the military that like Bolsonaro, that would like to stay in connection with Bolsonaro. But at this point, the military would lose so much clout. This is clout that it's built over the last 40 years since the end of the dictatorship, and they just don't want to go down that road.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Michael Fox is a freelance journalist, has the podcast Brazil on Fire, sponsored by both NACLA and Real News Network, and Professor Thiago Amparo, professor of international law and human rights at FGV and a newspaper columnist, speaking to us from São Paulo. This is Democracy Now! Next up, we look at Biden's first trip to U.S.-Mexico border as president. Stay with us.
Nous sommes légion, foulant le sol vers l'horizon du cœur au ventre. Une âme qui chante à contre-sens de la vie. Individualité sévit, société malade, devenue trop faible. Jusqu'à six pieds sous terre, les prières se soulèvent. Les armes du changement exigent une trêve. M'annoncer sans langue, le langage soumis-moi. Yahweh, Yahweh, en bas la ville au camp. En bas la ville au camp. En des changements.
World Prayer by Shirley Skye. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden's in Mexico City for the North American Leaders Summit with Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador and the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. This comes after Biden announced Thursday the United States will start to block migrants from Haiti, Nicaragua, Venezuela, and Cuba from applying for asylum if they're apprehended crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. The move, an expansion of the contested Trump-era Title 42 pandemic policy set to be reviewed by the U.S. Supreme Court. After the announcement, agents on Friday expelled dozens of Venezuelan migrants to Ciudad Juarez in Mexico, across from the U.S. city of El Paso. This is Venezuelan asylum seeker Jonathan Tovar.
It doesn't matter where they deport me. I will return, because I want the well-being of my children. For them to be able to study, to have the education I never had, I want the President of the United States to give me the opportunity to be here.
Mexico, he visited El Paso, which was one of the country's busiest border crossings, in his first visit to the border since taking office 2 years ago. Ahead of his arrival, border agents and police arrested migrants sleeping outside the Sacred Heart Catholic Church shelter. State troopers have patrolled El Paso's streets since the city issued a disaster declaration last month to address hundreds of asylum seekers and refugees needing assistance. During Biden's four-hour visit to El Paso, he visited a border crossing, walked along a metal border fence, stopped by the El Paso County Migrant Services Center, but reportedly did not meet with any migrants. For more, we're joined by two guests. Gerlene Joseph is executive director of the Haitian Bridge Alliance, an immigrant advocacy group that provides humanitarian assistance to Haitians and other Black immigrants from the Caribbean and Africa. And in El Paso, we're joined by Fernando Garcia. He is executive director of the El Paso-based Border Network for Human Rights. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! Fernando, let's begin with you. Can you describe this first-time visit of President Joe Biden to the border since he came into office, who he met with, and significantly, who he didn't meet with?
Hi, Amy. Good morning. Listen, I think there's a big level of disappointment in here in El Paso region, but not only within communities, but also NGOs, not only because it was a very short trip. The visit lasted less than 3 hours, but also in the context where it happens. I mean, as you already mentioned, there's an announcement by the president that he's implementing this extension of this anti-immigrant provision, or what is called Title 42, that is expelling a lot of migrants illegally. Now he's expanding it to Nicaraguans, Cubans, and Haitians, along with Venezuelans. So I think in that context, he's coming to El Paso, and he did not meet with any of these impacted communities. There's a lot of Venezuelans in downtown El Paso, eager to have a solution for them. And we have hundreds of families there that were waiting for some kind of answers to their plea in terms of us, or of having some process for asylum or refuge. So that didn't happen. So I think there's a level of frustrations, outraged by the fact that the president promised a different approach to immigration and immigration enforcement, but now he's using Trumpist strategies to keep expelling people. So I think nobody's happy here in El Paso.
So the administration said, even though he was in this refugee relief center, there just didn't happen to be any refugees there at the time. Talk about the crisis at the border right now and his emphasis, which he said he was going to emphasize before, on law enforcement, as opposed to the kind of work that you do helping people and meeting with. Well, did you meet with President Biden?
No, we did not. And actually, not that many people got to meet. I mean, when I say that not that many people, it's not that many stakeholders actually got to meet with the president. I think he did exactly the opposite of what we're expecting, because we were expecting for him to come to visit El Paso, what he was welcome. We would expect him to come and meet with community organizations, with families. I mean, there was families, refugees in downtown El Paso, that they are exposed to these freezing conditions right now. I mean, they are living in a very harsh environment. They are very visible. I mean, in especially there's this church that is called Sacred Heart downtown El Paso, where they are there actually in the streets. So the president should just probably just ride by that street along that church, and he will see all of these situations that actually entails the humanitarian crisis at the border. And I think either they wanted to ignore it, or they didn't care about those families out there in downtown El Paso. So I think the president failed in their opportunity to really connect with border residents and migrants. And it probably seems that was just a photo op. I mean, just to do the check mark in the checklist that he already visited the border, but I don't think this was a substantial, helpful visit.
And what would you told him if you had met with him, Fernando Garcia?
The first thing is that, please, President, you are not, what we believe is that you are not a racist, you're not anti-immigrant. Don't use Title 42. Don't expand it. You were against it. You criticized it before, and now you're expanding it, and now you're setting up to expel thousands and thousands of people to Mexico, where there's a lot of violence. Secondly, give the people that is here already, that already crossed the border, an opportunity to find a process for them. I mean, because you have left them in the limbo. I mean, you're just offering them expulsions, and there's a lot of families, a lot of children, that they don't know, they don't have a place to go, and they are suffering a very harsh policy that you, President, are embracing. And thirdly, I think it is very important that the President understand that we need more welcoming infrastructure at the border, because whatever we're doing on the ground, NGOs, churches, local cities, is not enough, and it's not sustainable. This is something that the federal government broke. I mean, not only this administration, but previous administration, they broke the system, so they need to fix it.
I want to bring Gerline Joseph into this conversation, executive director of the Haitian Bridge Alliance. And I want to ask you about this program that they've said they expanded in the last days, calling it the Humanitarian Parole Program, saying they would accept up to 30,000 migrants per month from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, Venezuela. But what wasn't talked about as much is they're expelling up to 30,000 migrants a month who cross without applying. Can you talk about what exactly this means?
Good morning. Thank you so much, Amy, for having me again. Honestly, this is where we once again see they bring a program that is supposed to be welcoming about 30,000 people from the four countries you mentioned, Haiti, Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. But in reality, this is causing a lot of confusions because at the same time, the accord between the United States and Mexico is for them to return 30,000 people from those countries back to Mexico if they try to seek asylum, if they try to seek protection outside of those parameters. And we see that as an extension of the Title 42 that we have been fighting very hard for them to end. So now we have this little carrot where they say, okay, we are going to allow 30,000 people, but at the same time, what that policy does, it closes any other avenues for people to come and seek asylum.
Finally, we're having a little trouble with your sound, but I wanted to ask you, you're in Mexico City right now. Can you talk about, not in Mexico City right now, but you spend a lot of time there and you have been looking at the effects of the policy, particularly on Haitians. You're one of the only Black-led organizations that deals with Black refugees, especially Haitians, coming up over the border. Can you talk about those that are left behind in Mexico and what happens to them?
Right now, if you are in Mexico from those four countries and you try to enter the United States outside of that parole program, you will be barred from entering. You will be returned to Mexico and you will be barred from participating in the future to get that protection that you seek. So what the president said is to wait and stay where you are. But the reality is when you have a woman who was gang raped in a country like Haiti or fleeing Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua in the Darien, and this comes out, they arrive, they have absolutely no way to get protection because what is required for them, they have to have a passport. In addition to having a passport, they have to have a sponsor in the United States who agrees to sponsor them. The reality is this program will be closed to the most vulnerable people, especially those who are in mobility, whether they are in the Darien forest dying right now, or they are in Guatemala or other places, because if they try to cross any other countries to make it to the United States, they will be barred from even participating in getting any type of protection.
Well, Gerline Joseph, we want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of the Haitian Bridge Alliance. And thank you to Fernando Garcia. Fernando, if you're still there, I have one last question. And that is, yes, President Biden is now meeting with AMLO, with the Mexican president and the Canadian prime minister in a North American leaders conference right now in Mexico City. What do you think Mexico needs to do and what the United States should be partnering with Mexico around right now?
You know, I'm very sure that Mexico do not have to do the dirty immigration enforcement work of the United States. I mean, this idea that we're going to have 30,000 refugees and migrants being sent to Mexico every month in the midst of this violence. I mean, you heard that there's this violence in Juarez, in Sinaloa, even in Mexico City. So just the idea that we're sending migrants to a very violent situation, it is not a solution. I think Mexico should actually stand their ground and say, we're not going to accept anything that violates international human rights, that violates the the basic right to ask for asylum, which the United States has been violating. So I think they need to adhere to the and uphold the asylum laws that they are broken. They are breaking right now.
I want to thank you, Fernando Garcia, Executive Director of Border Network for Human Rights, speaking to us from El Paso, Texas, where President Biden visited yesterday for the first time as president, going to the southern border. Tomorrow we'll talk about his meeting in Mexico. We thank you both for being with us. Next up, Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government facing outcry after rescinding a fellowship to Ken Roth, the former head of Human Rights Watch, over Human Rights Watch's criticism of Israel's human rights record. Stay with us.
You've traveled so far, and you finally are where you belong. You've braved mountains and valleys just to reach me. Now they tell us you don't belong. Say you staying is wrong. The side you were born on makes you welcome here. They have made you a stranger in a strange land, but your heart leads you without fear. Just when you begin to let go, my love makes you feel at home in this world. All we've done to be close, they tear apart, and we start
all over again by Esperanza Spalding and Stanley Clark. Spalding has announced she's leaving Harvard, saying, quote, sadly, what I aspire to cultivate and activate in organized learning spaces is not yet aligned with Harvard's priorities. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Harvard's Kennedy School of Government is facing growing outcry for rescinding a fellowship for the former head of Human Rights Watch, Kenneth Roth, over his criticism and the group's criticism of Israel's human rights record. Ken Roth is one of the most recognized human rights defenders in the world. He headed Human Rights Watch from 1993 to 2022. In 2021, Human Rights Watch made headlines when it published a major report accusing Israel of committing crimes against humanity, including apartheid. In June, Ken Roth agreed to take a fellowship at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy inside Harvard's Kennedy School. But several weeks later, Roth learned Harvard Kennedy School Dean Douglas Elmendorf had vetoed the fellowship. Roth was told it was because he criticized Israel. The American Civil Liberties Union has called Harvard's decision to rescind the fellowship to Ken Roth, quote, profoundly troubling. PEN America has also criticized Harvard's decision, saying in a statement, quote, withholding Roth's participation in a human rights program due to his own staunch critiques of human rights abuses by governments worldwide raises serious questions about the credibility of the Harvard program itself, they said. Kenneth Roth joins us now from Geneva, Switzerland. Ken Roth, welcome back to Democracy Now! Talk about what's happened, what you understand, why it is you are not at Harvard enjoying this fellowship.
Well, I mean, as you just said, it's because I and Human Rights Watch criticized Israel. The Carr Center, the Human Rights Center at the Kennedy School, wanted me. They called me up, you know, as soon as I announced that I would be leaving Human Rights Watch. And it made sense for me to go there because I'm working on a book and this would be a kind of very logical place for me to try to do that. We thought that that was the end of the story, that the dean's approval of my fellowship would be, you know, a perfunctory matter. It happens all the time. And I was shocked when he vetoed it because of our criticism of Israel. I had a slight inkling of this when I spoke to the dean in July. He asked me after about a half hour of very, you know, pleasant, normal conversation, he said, do you have any enemies? I thought it was a bit of a weird question because, you know, as head of Human Rights Watch, I have a lot of enemies. I mentioned to him that, you know, the Chinese government and the Russian government have both personally sanctioned me. Governments like the Saudi government or the Rwandan government hate me. But you know, I knew what he was driving at. So I mentioned, yes, and of course the Israeli government hates me too. That was the end of the matter. 2 weeks later, I learned through the very respected professor at the Kennedy School, Catherine Sinkink, that Elmendorf, the dean, had told her that it was our criticism of Israel that was the death knell for my fellowship.
Been at Human Rights Watch for close to, what, 30 years. Talk about Human Rights Watch's stand on Israel, how it compares to Amnesty International's, also did a big report on Israel as an apartheid state, but also your reports on Saudi Arabia and other countries in the Middle East.
Well, Human Rights Watch applies the exact same standards to Israel as we do to 100 other countries that we regularly monitor. That is to say, we insist on scrupulous factual objectivity, and then we apply those facts under international human rights and humanitarian law. So the exact same process we use every place else. Because there is an Israeli-Palestinian conflict, we also, as a matter of principle, scrutinize the other players in that conflict. So Human Rights Watch reports critically on the Palestinian Authority, on Hamas, on Hezbollah, and this is what we do in every other conflict around the world as well. So there's really no difference between what Human Rights Watch does on Israel and every place else. The big difference is that there are a group of organized supporters of the Israeli government, often masquerading around behind sort of civic groups with very neutral sounding names, who attack anybody who criticizes Israel. And Human Rights Watch and me personally, we tend to be at the forefront of their attacks. Now, I don't think that's what was going on directly with the Kennedy School dean, but he easily could have read their material. Certainly since this decision was announced, these same groups have been saying, oh, Human Rights Watch is biased. But what they really mean is we hold Israel to the same standards as everybody else. They don't want somewhat fewer reports or maybe fewer tweets by me. They want no criticism of Israel. They want us to exempt Israel from human rights scrutiny. And no credible human rights group could possibly do that.
Who do you believe is behind the pressure for you, for example, not to be a fellow at the Kennedy School? Do you believe it's donors to Harvard, and what kind of role do they play there?
I'm not hearing you if you're...
Oh, can you hear me now? I'm saying, do you believe donors to Harvard played a role in your rejection as
a
fellow?
Now you're coming back. Hello?
Do you believe your role as a fellow, do you believe that donors' roles to Harvard are a factor in your denial, the rescinding of your fellowship?
Well, I have no direct evidence of that, but I think it's the only plausible explanation. In other words, Elmendorf, the dean, he doesn't have a history of defending Israel. I don't think he personally cares. But as Michael Massing showed in his excellent expose in The Nation on this issue, the Kennedy School has a few big donors who are big supporters of Israel. And I think the real fear here is that, either he consulted with them or he feared what they would say, but he allowed their preferences to yield to his censorship. In other words, he apparently allowed donors to violate the principle of academic freedom. And this is a very serious problem. It's not just a problem for me personally. This is not, impeding my career in a significant way. But I think about, first of all, the younger academics who don't have, the visibility that I do, who are going to take from this lesson the view that if you touch Israel, if you criticize Israel, that can be a career-killing move. You'll get canceled. And that's a disastrous signal to send. But the other, I think, big issue here is that if there is any institution in the world, any academic institution that could resist this kind of donor pressure, it's Harvard. Harvard is, the richest university in the world. Harvard should be saying, we, as a matter of principle, will not accept contributions from donors who insist on violating academic freedom. They are not making that statement. Right now, they're just lying low and leaving us to have to surmise that it was this kind of donor pressure that led to this cancellation of my fellowship and this effort to really undermine academic freedom. I hope that Harvard takes this as an opportunity to clarify that donor preferences never will be allowed to violate academic freedom. But their silence so far says the opposite.
Peter Beinart had an interesting op-ed in the New York Times in August headlined, "Has the fight against anti-Semitism lost its way?" He said, quote, "Over the past 18 months, America's most prominent Jewish organizations have done something extraordinary. They've accused the world's leading human rights organizations of promoting hatred of Jews," Peter Beinart wrote. Talk about who these Jewish organizations are. Do you think they had anything to do with what happened to you and your own background, your family and relation to the Holocaust?
Well, I mean, first of all, me personally, I'm Jewish. My father grew up in Nazi Germany and fled in July 1938 to the United States. You know, I grew up hearing Hitler stories. That's a lot of why I went into the effort to defend human rights. It was sort of what I brought from that experience. So, you know, the accusation that I'm anti-Semitic is just ridiculous. But there is a real effort to redefine anti-Semitism to mean essentially criticism of Israel. Now, they don't say that explicitly. They say, oh, you're demonizing Israel. But, you know, of course, human rights advocacy is about demonizing abusive governments. When Human Rights Watch reports on abuses and publicizes them, we are trying to demonize governments around the world. That's what we do. That's how we shame governments and pressure them into changing. So to say, oh, we're demonizing Israel, therefore we're anti-Semitic, is basically saying, don't criticize Israel. And, you know, we're not going to fall for that ploy, but it worries me because it's cheapening the very important concept of anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is a real, vibrant threat. But if it is dumbed down to mean just any criticism of Israel, people are going to stop getting outraged about anti-Semitism and think, oh, this is just the abusive Israel government or its supporters trying to defend Israel. That it would be a shame for the effort to combat anti-Semitism.
Can you talk about the Belfer Center and who is behind the Belfer Center and the role that it has played in shaping the discourse or trying to limit criticism of Israel?
Well, Michael Massing in The Nation talks about the Belfer Center, which is, I think, the biggest part of the Kennedy School. It has many, many fellowships of the sort that, you know, I was just denied, including an Israeli general was given one last year. It is filled with national security types. Now, you know, Michael wonders, you know, were these national security types behind the veto of my fellowship? Personally, I don't think that was it, because Human Rights Watch deals with national security types all around the world. They recognize us as you know, a respected institution. We're fact-based. We're principled. They may not like our criticisms, but, you know, we're just an accepted interlocutor. So the idea that they would, you know, deal with us every day in Washington, in London, in Brussels, but suddenly veto my fellowship at Harvard, I don't think that's feasible. But, you know, there are some donors behind the Belfer Center who are big supporters of Israel. And you know, that, I think, is probably the more likely explanation. Not necessarily that they insisted on this, but that the Kennedy School Dean, Elmendorf, feared that they might object to my appointment. God knows why, because, you know, frankly, my counterparts from Amnesty, from Human Rights Watch, have had prior fellowships there, and nobody seemed to care. But Elmendorf seems suddenly ultra-sensitive to the possibility that he might be criticized for appointing me because Israel is among the 100 governments that I and Human Rights Watch criticize.
And Ken Roth,
this is something that, you know, has been a problem in other places as well.
This is particularly significant now, given that Israel now has perhaps the most far-right government in its history. We have about 30 seconds, if you could respond.
I mean, what I worry about is that this new Netanyahu government, which has clearly had to placate the far-right in order to secure power, is going to be more repressive than even the Israeli government under him previously had been. And so, you know, this apartheid treatment of the Palestinians, I fear, is only going to get worse.
And where do you end up, Kenneth Roth?
Well, I am writing my book this year. I took a fellowship at the University of Pennsylvania. I'm currently looking at a few possibilities to begin a professorship starting in September. I'll probably decide that soon. So I'm going to continue writing about human rights, speaking about human rights, and being part of the cause, just no longer a formal part of Human Rights Watch.
Kenneth Roth, former longtime executive director at Human Rights Watch. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Gozder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, to Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnock, Jerome Nadura, Samuel Fruchton, Murray Out Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, and Eric Conlon. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with criminal defense attorney and law professor Justin Brooks about his new book, You Might Go to Prison Even Though You're Innocent.
We'll hear from Justin about his work over the past 30 years getting innocent people released from prison.
We'll also take a look at junior ROTC programs on high school campuses around the country and a new development of automatic enrollments.
Our guest is Rick Johncow, who works for two San Diego-based anti-militarist organizations.
Stay with us.
I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
I am civil rights attorney Julie Hurwitz, a partner in the law firm of Goodman, Hurwitz & James, based in Detroit, Michigan, and a board member of the Michigan chapter of the National Lawyers Guild.
There is a common belief that if you're arrested, you're probably guilty because where there's smoke, there's fire. People assume that only the guilty confess to crimes, because why would an innocent person confess to a crime they didn't commit? And when a person pleads guilty or is convicted by a jury, that's the end of the matter in the minds of most people. In fact, many innocent people are arrested, especially people of color, due to racial profiling and other forms of discrimination by law enforcement. Implicit bias often infects the case as it moves through the criminal legal system, from the initial police stop to interrogation, arrest, charging, trial, and sentencing. This is particularly tragic when a person is charged with a capital crime for which the death penalty is imposed and that sentence is carried out. However, it is estimated that between 10,000 and 20,000 people are currently serving time in prison after being convicted of crimes they did not commit, largely due to prosecutorial misconduct and police misconduct. Unfortunately, even when exonerated, the psychological and physical damage done is so extensive that many people are never able to fully recover from the trauma. In addition, when the wrongful conviction is solely the result of prosecutorial misconduct, those convicted have no legal resource to be compensated for the wrong done to them because of prosecutorial immunity. Criminal defense attorney and law professor Justin Brooks has spent decades working to free innocent people from prison. The founding director of the California Innocence Project, Brooks is the author of the provocative new book, You Might Go to Prison Even Though You're Innocent. In it, he discusses false identifications, junk science, lying snitches, and incompetent defense lawyers, which all too often lead to the imprisonment of innocent people. My co-host Julie Hurwitz and I, Marjorie Cohn, are fortunate today to speak with Justin Brooks about these injustices in the criminal legal system and how they can be remedied. Justin Brooks, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much.
Since the 1990s, thousands of innocent people have been freed from prison. How many successes has the California Innocence Project had with exonerating the wrongfully convicted? How do you decide which cases to take? How do you fund your work? And how long does it generally take to exonerate an innocent person?
Those are a lot of good questions. So I've personally had the privilege of walking 36 of my clients out of prison, but this work has been replicated all around the country. And it's been really amazing to see other innocence organizations, defense attorneys, and sometimes even prosecutors who have played this role in exonerating innocent people, and the numbers keep going up every year. How do we decide which cases to take? That is actually the most difficult and most heartbreaking